Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Dedicated to Henry Farman. In the year of the primal form, the dawn of terrestrial birth, man mastered the mammoth and horse, and man was the lord of the earth. He made him an olive skin from the heart of an olive tree. He compassed the earth therein, and man was the lord of the sea. He controlled the vigor of steam, he harnessed the lightning for hire, he drove the celestial team, and man was the lord.
Well, 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 my friends, welcome to episode 61 of Agitators Anonymous. This is Alan Averill speaking. How are we now that we are in our 60s? 60 is the new 50 or something like that. Well, today's podcast is a very special guest, which is also a video cast over on my YouTube channel. So go over there and take a look. There's also some other heavy metal chat. I realized that I was sitting on this particular episode for a few weeks, if not a few months. And God damn it, if I shouldn't get the finger out and release the damn bloody thing. So here we go. This is a man who played on one of my favorite records of all time, and that would be Order from Chaos, Stillbirth Machine. As you will find out, Chuck's opinion of that is a little bit different to mine, but Order from Chaos was one of my very favorite bands of all time. Me and Chuck have stood in the same room with different groups of people, passed each other in the hallways here and there, passed each other and never quite sat down for a chat. So it was long overdue that we had a chat. Of course, Chuck also plays in Ares Kingdom, another great band, Volpelcula. All sorts of interesting things. He's an articulate, witty, insightful, and clever conversation partner, and you should enjoy this one. Even if you don't know the bands, I mean, look, you should go and check them out. But that's part of what Agitators Anonymous is. Random kind of all over the place chats. Normal service will be resumed. I had a very special podcast recorded, and I thought, God damn, I should put that conversation with Chuck out there. All right. All sorts of interesting things. Chuck was a very close friend of Cawthon from Bathory. We discussed that. So if you're looking for some really juicy, intimate Bathory details, hang in there. We get to that. He is very has some very interesting views about American society, about lockdown, about all of those kind of things. So, and also he's an original of the metal species. So there's lots of old metal chat. So without further ado, I will first read the three ad reads. www.metalblade.com. You can go there if you're in North America and use the promo code AAPODCAST and you will get 10% off. You want to buy the new Cannibal Corpse, a million other things. Go and check it out. Secondly, I am sponsored by Hate Couture. I hate you as in HateCouture 616.com. Hateful yet tasteful apparel. The veneration of serial killers and tyrants that are designed to piss off your nearest and dearest. You know you want that, right? Go and check out the site. All sorts of crazy stuff on there. And use the promo code ALAN and you'll get free shipping, which, believe me, counts for a lot these days. And thirdly, Eisenwald Records. www.eisenton.de and .com. One of the biggest, brightest, darkest, most uncompromising record labels there is right now, coming up out of the underground. Loads of post-black metal, pagan black metal, really interesting dark stuff. Use the promo code ALAN and you'll get 10% off. Get to it. All right, here we go. The indomitable Chuck Keller.
All right, Agitators Anonymous episode, who knows? I'm here with Chuck Keller. Hello, Chuck, how are you?
Hello. Doing fine. Trying to thaw out over here, you know.
Yeah, so this is Order from Chaos, Fulpecula, Era's Kingdom. We're going to talk about your own personal interests, which I think will interest people on the podcast. A little bit of Bathory stuff, this, that, and the other, because you were a close friend of Corthon's. But I suppose let's start at the start, which is Order from Chaos, which must be, what, 87, 88? What's the first demo?
Yeah, 87. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I started in 87. The roots of it go back a little bit further. I had fallen into a new group of friends in going on late 86. One of them happened to be Pete. Yeah. And we played in a cover band. We were pretty good. To me, we were the best band in the city, apart from maybe one other. But all we did was covers.
Yeah, yeah.
And by the spring of 87, we're going, hey, this is boring. Let's start doing our own stuff. So Pete and I got to work, started writing music, and we could not interest the other guys. You know, it's the familiar story. Everybody has a story like this. And eventually that cover band fell apart, summer of 87. And I left, and then Pete left, and we joined together and started OFC. And, you know, we didn't have a drummer at first. We spent that whole autumn writing new material. And I said, you know, I played with a guy in high school, and I had known him since like first grade. So, you know, I had some old recordings of Mike and I kicking around playing old Metallica stuff. And he's like, yeah, yeah, call him up. So we had Mike come over, and he listened to our ratty ass demo and said, yeah, I want in. So, you know, he joined right then and there. And it was just the three of us from beginning to end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the thing that I guess that, I tape traded the demos maybe, you know, 89 or 90, but really it was a big package that arrived to me from Sack, who's from Rotting Christ, with the Unisound version of Stillbirth Machine.
Yeah.
That sort of, which still today is one of my very favorite records of that entire period. I'm going to get into that. But all the images in the fanzines at that time really set Order from Chaos really apart from so many other bands, because for a European who was fascinated, obviously, with the European black metal scene, you guys didn't look like the usual American band. And that's what sort of fascinated, in the fullness of time, so many Europeans who were drawn to that imagery, because you seem to stand out like miles from the sort of death metal scene of the time, or the Impetigos, or all those kind of bands, you know?
Yeah, we were stuck in the 80s. You know, we basically looked like Sodom did in the mid 80s. That's who we are. Who we were. We weren't going to pretend that we were something else. You know, we never, ever wore any makeup. Mm-hmm. That was out of the question from the very beginning. And we just were who we were, and we were more focused on the music than the imagery. I mean, imagery's, it's damned important. There's no doubt about it. And if they were in the band, they paid no attention to images or to imagery. I mean, apart from what we were doing on the records. And we always like to say, you know, we formed because of Venom. We formed because of Sodom, Bathory, Slayer, Metallica. And what did those, apart from Slayer, what did most of those bands look like? They kind of look like us. Bullets, spikes, leather, that's it. And we were never really embraced or, what's the word? My stupid phone's going off. Shut up. We were never really embraced by the extreme death metal crowd because we didn't grind. You know, we weren't, and we didn't do any of that shit. You know, and it was all cool in 88 and 89 when it was new, but after a while, it just became this ridiculous crutch that everybody's expected to do that. Fast forward to today, that's what most bands do, is, you know.
it did always struck me that you guys, or at least seemed more aligned with many of the South American or European bands that I was drawn to, the same sort of imagery. And it, like I said, it seemed very at odds with the American scene. But who were the other bands in your area? Like, you guys were sort of stuck on your own a bit, right?
None. There was really no. There was no other bands. Oh, well, there was one. There was a band called Vavictus. Okay. And I think they finally have their own metal archives page. But for years, there was nothing about them. And they were a local basically a demo band. They never did anything but two demos, and they were just the typical jeans and t-shirts kind of guys, but they had a lot in common with us. Creator, Sodom, you know, Slayer were their primary influences. Voivod, you know.
Yeah.
And so our bands were really tight, but it was the end of their life. They caught a disease that I commonly call Soundgarden, where they heard that shitty band and decided that's what we want to do.
Yeah, okay.
And so they ran off and alienated from one another. And I want to do this, I want to do that. But ultimately, the guys that were really making the decisions wanted to do.
Yeah, in Ireland, it was called The Prodigy.
Do the Soundgarden thing. And so the whole band just fell apart.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I get it.
In Ireland.
To this day, I have... Yeah, to this day, I have an absolute hatred of Soundgarden because I blame them for breaking up Vivictus, which is the only other great band from Kansas City.
Right, yeah. But, like, I remember getting that package from Sackers and putting on Stillbirth Machine. And to this day, I was playing it to the guys from Malthusian, slightly younger generation than me guys here. We're talking about Stillbirth Machine, and I was, you know, wildly gesticulating about it and, you know, that they had to... You have to hear this fucking record. But it still struck me almost 30 years later, the caustic nature of the tone was just still so striking now. It's the same thing happened to me almost 30 years later. Like, where the fuck did that come from? Because it still is one of my favorite sounds of any record of that period.
Well, I'll tread carefully because I think it's pretty well known. I hate that album. I love the songs. I hate the sound of that album.
Really?
Well, I hate the guitar tone. I think the drums sound great. Bass sounds great. Vocals sound great. Guitars are shit.
Mm.
And it was, I overthought it. And I take on all the blame myself. We had a producer that we had worked with since Crushed Infamy.
Yeah, sure.
Which came out great. That's still one of my favorite recordings.
Yeah.
But we could never recapture that set of balls. And we didn't until basically an Ending in Fire.
Right.
But Stillbirth Machine was our last recording project with that old producer. And at that point, he had kind of backed away and just let me have my way. And because I was closer to him and also where we were recording, I was kind of driving the recording process. And I recorded the guitars. And you know how it is. You make a recording, you get a cassette of it back in those days. You take it home, you start playing it on your stereos to decide whether or not you like it. And I'm like, this is all crap. I was so frustrated. And Ron finally said, well, let's just re-record the guitars. I'm like, okay, yeah, let's do that. And to this day, I thought I used my old Marshall MOSFET to record both sessions. I may not have, I just don't remember. I've asked Mike, I'm like, do you remember? No, I have no idea. Well, we wasted months re-recording it. Maybe from your perspective, you're gonna go, I'm glad you did because it came out really well. This is what I like. But that was not at all the vision I had for Stillbirth Machine. So maybe it's better I didn't get my way, but.
I think maybe that is the difference between a singer and a guitar player then. But I still, like, for me, 30 years on from when I got it, it still does the same thing to me when I hear that record. And I'm struck by the attack. It may not be the attack, the tone of the attack that you might have intended, but back then in 91, it set you guys out so differently from all of the other things that were happening. Like, it was almost like, well, of course it was cult as people came to you with capital K.
It was
sort of like spoken about in hushed terms. I remember saying to Dara from Invictus, listen, you know, have you heard this fucking Order from Chaos record? Maybe a year or two later, and you know, it was hushed tones, and not sure you'll like it kind of thing, you know. And I suppose it's kind of spread amongst all the kind of people who you kind of thought, well, maybe you should hear this or maybe you shouldn't. But I don't know. That's interesting you say that, because I'm sure if you said to Kieran from Primordial, somebody said, oh, I love the tone on the first album in Rama from 93. He'd be like, oh. Because it reminds him of playing through some tiny little combo.
Exactly.
Or something, you know?
Exactly. To guys that, you know, that the tone is everything, or the guys that were directly involved in the production, if it isn't right for them, we're always going to go, oh, I don't know, man. It's just, I'm glad you like it. I mean, I guess I wouldn't change a thing in retrospect, but ultimately, you know.
Well, I've kind of never had the attitude of being, I've never been a total purist about the sound or of any of the records that I've made, in the sense that if it feels kind of right, I let it go. I'm not, I don't tweak and tweak and tweak. I'm not a perfectionist.
Well, as a fan, I do this. As the fan, I don't make those, I don't make those kind of demands on a record. I will accept whatever's handed to me and see if I like it in its context. Do I need to, do I need to look in a little deeper? I mean, because there are some albums that have absolutely terrible production that we all adore, you know. I mean, there's, I have the same way. You look at the old Rotting Christ stuff. Some of that stuff is just like, you wanted it to sound like that, but as a fan, I'm like, I can't envision this sounding any other way.
Well, so me, I guess for me it was maybe the similar thing was when I first heard maybe War and Pain or something. Trying to get my head around that compared to what, you know, you're listening to other thrash bands. And it was a real, you know, that or Bathory was a real, they were real room splitters. You could see Possessed could appeal to thrash metal fans, but Voivod, War and Pain, like I remember playing that to people back then, they were just, what, just no. And oddly enough, it was Dead Kennedys fans and Minor Threat fans sometimes who seemed to sort of like it more, because the kind of the crudeness of Venom had been sort of forgotten by 88, 89. Everybody wanted, I suppose, Practice What You Preach and Nuclear Assault and all that kind of thing. But after Stillbirth Machine, you have what then? You have the Plateau of Invincibility and I Saw Eternity EPs, right?
Through the Dawnbringer. It was a Plateau, which was supposed to be the great reset in terms of production. We got, you know, OFC only ever really worked in one truly professional studio, and it was for Stillbirth Machine.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a functioning studio at that point. I don't know if you remember the old American band Shooting Star.
No,
but okay, well, there was a, they had some mild success somewhere, some places in Europe they're known. Anyway, the owner of that studio was the brother of Ron, the producer. And by that time, Shooting Star was pretty much dead.
Right.
Everybody was away raising families. No upkeep had been done on the studio. So we're in there recording. And that was a professional studio. All we had to really do was come up with the money for the 2-inch tape.
Yeah.
It's pretty simple for us. Ron worked free of charge. I mean, he would get shit hammered every session.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we'd get about 3 good hours out of him. And after that, we're like, okay, it's time to go home. You know, so that's why it took months to pull Stillbirth Machine together. Well, after that, we transitioned to another private studio that was actually a downgrade. It was an 8-track cassette studio.
Okay.
But it was cheap.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been conversing with Korth on how do you record? And, you know, he was a master of what seems obvious now about bouncing down to different tracks.
Bouncing down.
That was new to people like us. And he's like, do that. And I'm like, that's a great idea. So we can turn an 8-track cassette studio into basically 12, 14, 16 tracks.
Yeah.
So that's what we did. All the way through the end of An Ending in Fire and then into Vulpecula. Both Vulpecula sessions were recorded at the same studio.
Yeah, yeah. The Vulpecula first was, the first is Fons Immortalis, right? That has a really interesting sort of spacey sound, I suppose, which was a bit different in the playing technique from Order from Chaos, though, right?
Yeah, on purpose. I mean, after OFC was such an all-consuming thing for us that when it finally stopped, it was time for us to go. And I had been thinking about doing this quasi-space metal ambient project since as far back as 92 or 93.
Yeah.
And when OFC ended, I'm like, that's it. This is what I'm going to do. And I tapped the Nepenthe drummer, and he was a phenomenal keyboard player to do it with me. And of course his parents owned the studios, that also helped. So we pulled the Vulpecula stuff together. We started with a demo that got pressed on 7-inch called Phoenix of the Creation. And then we did Fons Immortalis, and then we recorded 4 or 5 tracks in 98 that ultimately became what Dara released for us as In Dusk Apparition.
I think you're probably partly to blame for, I suppose, everyone knowing about Order from Chaos, but just to go back a few years though, is Wild Rags Records, of course.
Endless
Wild Rags, like they would just arrive in your mailbox, 20 copies of the, you know, of the mail order, and then you'd be trying to charge for them. But we were always fascinated by the Milwaukee Metal Fest lineups. But Order from Chaos didn't really do many Europe. You didn't tour America back then, though. You just would play singular shows and that kind of thing.
Right, because OFC was never popular enough to pull in. We didn't have that kind of appeal.
Yeah.
Like I said, at that time, everybody wanted the grindy death metal. We didn't do that. We still played like Voivod.
Yeah.
So we weren't the band du jour.
Yeah.
We never were that. So we never got the same kind of opportunities. And, you know, you look back on it, you, all things being equal, you're like, maybe that's definitely the way it should have been. But at the time, it was hugely frustrating. We're a decent band. You know, we should have more opportunities than that.
Yeah.
You know, and our fan base was absolutely rabid.
Yeah,
people, the 10 people that liked us really liked us. For us, there was a huge disconnect. It didn't make any sense to us, and it was hugely frustrating. So we're pouring our heart and souls into everything that was Order from Chaos. And so in 95, when it finally ended, A Predestination, it was just like, okay.
Yeah.
So I went off and did Vulpecula.
Yeah. Because if you think about it, like, you know, at the time you have the first black metal tours, Rotting Cry, but Blasphemy were on the Fuck Christ tour. And it always struck me as odd that you guys didn't seem to have the same name as, let's say, a Blasphemy or where it didn't get opportunities. I know it was difficult in the early 90s for bands to come across from the US who weren't, you know, even Malevolent Creation style death metal, to come across and tour Europe. But there were still moments and there were still things happening and still small shows. It always struck me as, yeah, like you said, odd that it seemed like all of your fans were spread out across Europe and South America and stuff.
Right. And the same thing happens with Aries Kingdom.
Yeah.
You know, people that are unfamiliar with us, they just think, well, there's not a lot here on the surface. There's no pose here. There's nothing identifiable. So they can't be that big of a deal. And they see us play or they hear us play and they're like, oh my God, the old Max L man in the chair like this, you know.
So
we're kind of we call ourselves ambushers, where, you know, you put us on a bill with somebody, we're going to ambush the living shit out of them.
You're
not going to know what hit them.
Yeah, I know.
And it's just the way we do.
So maybe if you could think about like in Ireland, we have a thing where I think that most of the bands, like, you know, we started Primordial in 91. But it was still kind of gloomy and doomy. And most of the other bands who started around the same time, we have this sort of sodden, earthy, gloomy, sort of miserable air, tragic, semi-tragic air. But there was never the sort of southern equator fire in many of the bands of the music. And, you know, American bands from different, you know, the tri-state area, the Florida area, the, you know, the West Coast kind of sounds of the different bands. But you guys didn't seem to, in all of the things that you've done, to me, doesn't sound like it's specifically regional to some area in America. Does that make any sense?
Okay, should be back.
Yeah.
You hear me?
Yeah, you froze there for like two.
Okay, back. All right.
You see what you know what I mean? Maybe I'm trying to get at is that all the things you've done to me don't sound particularly American. Could that be too simplistic?
Not at all. Because we never wanted to sound like the typical American band. We didn't want to be Malevolent Creation. We didn't want to be Testament. We didn't want to be any of these bands that were archetypally American.
Sure.
We had more of a European view. You know, the people that we cut our teeth on that inspired us to pick up instruments, mostly the European bands. I mean, there's Slayer. Yeah, come on, of course. But beyond that, it was the European band. So that's how that was our frame of reference entirely. So it makes sense that you would look at us and go, they don't look American at all. And add to that the fact that we were so isolated in the Kansas City area that it makes sense that we would sound like no one else. And Yosuke, that runs NWN, his theory is he loves bands that are from the middle of nowhere. The one thing that he's noticed connecting dots is like if a band is their own scene, they tend to be really unique. And usually it's what he likes. But there's a lot of truth in what he says. I mean, you go up to Chicago, you go to New York, you go to Florida, and everybody's the bloody same.
Mm.
It's just you can tell they're from a certain area. And we just, luck of the draw, I don't know. In Missouri, it was frustrating because we never got any opportunities, and we were always kind of looked past. Looking back on it, you know, I guess it really shouldn't have been any other way.
And what was your first, let's say, what was your first show then you played with any of the bands that you've done in Europe? Can you remember that? And
the first real show we did.
You must have been hassled by Old Order from Chaos fans every
month. You don't mean what was the first OFC show?
No. Just like, because OFC didn't come to Europe till the, you know, the nuclear war thing. Yeah. But so you first came to Europe then to play with Aeris Kingdom, right?
Yeah, in 2009. I mean, it was, of course, there are lots of questions about OFT.
Yeah.
And at that time it was, are you going to reform? Are you going to do that? Yeah.
Sure.
Well, sure enough, we did. Like a year after our AK's first show in Europe, yeah, we did do those five OFC shows that ended at NWN. But yeah, I mean, the OFC is just always there. When we did that tour a few years ago in Europe, the OFC shirts everywhere, you know, so you just, it's part of the deal, man. You just go with it. It may not be what you're doing now, but it's part of the deal.
Yeah, it was very unusual for me to see, like I said, in 91, 92, just trying to get one of your shirts was almost impossible. Managed to get the odd one here and there, but no one would have known. And then by somewhere in the late 2000s, mid 2000s, or no, let's say 2001, 2002 was when the kind of Beharit blasphemy thing came through, the sort of transom or whatever you want to call it of the Black Death Metal scene, that sort of third generation. And everybody was like, you know, kind of Beharit blasphemy. Yeah. And OFC was coming in kind of right just behind that. And it was really strange to witness all of these, you know, 18 to 23 year old kids listening to the, you know, the three or four bands that in 1991 were, you know, there was only a handful of people that liked. But I suppose that's kind of it, that sometimes the impact of a band is only really felt through reverberations down through maybe a decade or two sometimes, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And OFC got staple gunned onto that wave of Beharit blasphemy. Even Sarcophago.
And
it kind of boggles my mind because we don't really have anything in common with those bands. So it's really odd to me. I think it was just, it was part of that time. But beyond that, I'm like, and I'm not poo-pooing it. I mean, it's great that we got tacked on somewhere, at least in our own time frame. But it's just weird that OFC of all bands gets tacked on to those kind of, you know, bands.
In my head at the time, like if you looked at the cassette, like I said, my tape trading cassettes, you would have seen like OFC, Mystifier, Master's Hammer, you know, Pro Fanatica, maybe something like that from the States. But they would have been coupled together, Rotting Christ, those kind of bands on the kind of cassette where you're tape trading and going, okay, this person isn't going to like, you know, fucking death, chunky death metal stuff. So yeah, for me, in my head, it makes sense that Sarcophago would be with Order from Chaos.
I'm good with that.
I would file that that would be filed in my own gray matter. Those would be on the same shelf, you know, somehow, file those things. But then the whole, I felt the same slow burn with Aeris Kingdom then. In the sense that I remember getting the first one, and by the time we come around to the third album, I think, is it, things, it's just some amount in building. People are talking
Unbearable
about
Dead.
The band and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and it's Slow Burn is exactly the right way to describe it. We're just kind of a grower band. You know, we don't have that immediate, you know, that makes everybody, we're not defleshed, you know. And so there is that. And when you sit down and you look at you deconstruct the songs and read the lyrics, you begin to see there's a lot there. And you're damn right there's a lot there. I pour everything into the lyrics and the concepts. So, you know, it's not just crucified Jesus and nuns raped. I mean, none of that. You write about what you know, and I don't know anything about any of that stuff. So I stick with what I do know, and I pour everything into it. And so when I find, especially with the last album, By the Light of Their Destruction, I mean, seeing people going, wait a minute, these lyrics are something special. That makes me happy.
I
think all of the lyrics have been special so far, but you know.
Oh, no, I can totally see that. I can totally understand that. So in a sense, we could say that throughout your musical career, then you've kind of managed to hold on to a certain sort of outsider status in terms of the sort of trends or whatever you want to call it through the decades. Is that something that you think about or that you are comfortable with, that idea that it's better to be recognized from the, you know, the kind of peers who understand it, then, as you said, B, I often think about this, that some bands get really popular for an album or two, and then never, they're always chasing their tail constantly for the decades that popularity goes down, you know? Sorry, that was a convoluted question, but, you know.
No, but it's true, and it's just something that I've grown to accept. I mean, for a while, it was a huge frustration. I'm like, why the hell am I doing this?
Yeah.
You know, I know that the quality of what we're doing is so much better than practically everything else out there. Why the hell am I doing this if nobody cares? Mm. But ultimately, as an artist, you're like, well, I care. It's what I do.
Like I said, the slow burn and residual effect.
Slow burn. Yeah.
It started to take effect in the last decade. I could see that for sure.
And that's what's really kind of softened the disappointment that was felt years ago. You know, the fact that things have finally come round and, you know, there is some recognition there.
Yeah. And I mean, like I said, even anecdotally, in my own experience of, like, say, being an Order from Chaos fan throughout all the decades, that my vicarious thrill of playing some of the records to people who are generations, you know, younger than me in the scene, and I'm going, what the fuck kind of thing. To me, that in some way, you know, we're going to say that's worth quite a lot fundamentally than going, oh, did you hear the debut album by such and such? Yeah, I heard it was good. Do you care? No, not really. The fact that somebody still feels so, like, I'd always stand up to bat for, like, you know, Satanist Tedium, Passage to Arcturo, you know, First Impel Nazarene EPs. That kind of stuff. And I'd always go into bat, you know, people would be like, oh, what are you doing with the Rotting Christ? I mean, blah, you know, the way they sounded, you know, some of the albums, the middle albums. So I love the new albums, but the middle albums, and I go, listen, have you heard Satanist Tedium? Shut the fuck up and listen to
The
Hill of Crucifixion or something. And generally the reaction is, what the fuck, you know? And I still still get that reaction now from Order from Chaos, I think has got to be quite rewarding somehow.
Well, yeah, I mean, just to hear it from you, it is incredibly rewarding. It really makes me feel good. Like, I haven't truly, none of us have wasted our time doing this. So it's just really a great thing to hear. And it's certainly something that is gratifying.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, like I said, it's bizarre that through all the years we managed to miss each other, whereas I might be standing in room B when you were in room A at the same festival. But sure, that's how it goes sometimes. But here we are.
Well, I think back in those days, we didn't know how much we both loved Holy Terror. So
that
may have been part of it, you know.
Yeah, honestly, Mind Wars is my favorite heavy metal record ever made, I think.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I had to do a podcast just about it, and I managed to ramble for like 30, 35 minutes just off the top of my head just about it. Because it was my uncle gave me that record. I think it was like November 1988. He used to work in a secondhand record store on the Saturdays. Sometimes he would just like take two or three records and just give them to me. And it would always be like, oh, here's the new Every Mother's Nightmare or something. I'm like, oh, okay. But he hit a home run one day when he gave me Mind Wars and I think Dark Angel. I think the live album, I can't remember. But it was Dark Angel and Holy Terror. And that was somewhere at the end of 88. But yeah, Holy Terror was, again, a band that sounds like such an anomaly for the American thrash scene. It's a really strange band.
Yeah, it really was. And I remember that I worked in a record store from 1986 to about late 1990. I mean, during, you know, golden years of thrash all the way through early death metal. And Holy Terror being on Under One Flag, obviously that's an import here in the States.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. I loved Under One Flag releases because they seemed to put so much into them. The quality was so much better in the vinyl and the print and the time that the band seemed to take with their records. So when a new Sacrilege came out or, you know, the first Holy Terror album came out, and I'm like, what is this? It pushed you on the back foot because it didn't sound like what the record looked like, but it also wasn't inappropriate. So it was challenging in a long-term sense. It's something that took you some time to wrap your head around. And then, like you say, by the time Mind Wars came out, you're like,
yeah,
that's where they really hit their stride. It's one of those weird points where you look at it, or you point to a band's career to the uninitiated, and it's one of those weird moments you can say the second album is better than the first.
Normally it's
the other way around, right? Yeah. But, you know, Mind Wars, I'm with you.
Yeah, and I remember talking to Mille from Creator, and he told me about touring with them for Mind Wars and how the band practically self-destructed on tour with him. and his story about what they were like, and also the level of their musicianship, but just kind of being off the dial. But as people, he could see they were like, oh, here's a band who are not long for this world, you know?
Right.
And oddly enough,
our other guitarist that's not playing with us currently, he saw Holy Terror in 88.
Yeah.
I was away on a family holiday and he got to see them. I think they were on tour with DRI.
Yeah.
And I'm super jealous of him for having seen them. Yeah. But he said it would have been the end of that 88 tour where everything really was falling apart.
Yeah.
And he said they clearly did not give a shit.
Yeah.
Said Keith Dean got up there and I think it was Pink Sweats and he had a beer and a cigarette and he's smoking doing the vocals and, you know, Kurt's killing it, obviously. Yeah. But he's like, it was fantastic. But he gives, you could tell that they were just not, they were going through the motions. I'm like, yeah, but you still saw them.
Yeah. They were announced to play here, I think, as a support to Exodus and Nuclear Assault, and the tour got cancelled. And then they played in the UK with, I think, Napalm Death and DRI, and then the Creator tour in Europe. And I think that's about, I think after that, they just combusted. But oddly enough, I was in touch with Kurt Kilfelt through email about, must be nearly 20 years ago. I tracked his email down from some old website, and I wanted to send him Primordial CDs, to just send him everything. And I from what I remember, my memory says to me now, probably somebody's going to come on in the comments and go, that's not the way it was at all. But the bass player of High on Fire, Jeff, really good guy, he played in a ill-fated Holy Terror reunion for one show where he played the bass. And I think they played in 2001, opening for an Iron Maiden covers band with a Paul Di'Anno singer, just like 25, 30 people, not really Reformation, but just like they all came up and played. Floyd and, what was the other guitar player's name? I can't remember. He probably kicked my ass.
Mike Alford.
And I heard that there was some kind of, they played a few songs to about 25 people.
Mike Alvord.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And it was unusual when I sent him all the Primordial stuff. He's like, oh, but people still give a shit about the band. Yeah, they do. And he was like, oh, I was thinking of making a new demo. And I was thinking to myself, he's surely not going to ask me to sing. Surely not. So I was sitting there going, would you sing for Holy Terror if you were asked? And then I came to the conclusion that, no, you shouldn't. Don't ruin your favorite band.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I understand. I get it.
Although,
it would have been cool just to be asked, though, you know.
Yeah, I'm not sure if the asking was forthcoming, but in my head, I thought that was going to be the next question. But we did a recording, a bit of a recording of Distant Calling a few albums ago with Primordial. We just never put the solos and stuff to it and never finished it. I must try and find it somewhere and finish it.
Yeah, but, finish it up.
But I wanted to ask you there, like pivot a tiny bit, because you talked about the lyrics of Erith's Kingdom, and I suppose this would be a good segue into your own personal interests that have sort of influenced the lyrics. You were saying astronomy, cosmology, and what you wrote to me was your appraisal of historic artifacts. That sounds kind of fascinating in itself. What exactly does that entail?
Well, I'm a degreed historian that doesn't want to teach.
All right.
And so, what else are you going to do? Yeah. So I started out working for auction houses in the 90s as a researcher and writer, and worked with a lot of military history. And then I segued into fine art, higher end antiques, rare antiquarian books, things like that. And obviously, historical stuff. So that's what I do for a living. That's the only way. You can't make money doing music, obviously. But it's what I'm around all the time, and it's deeply inspiring. The historical side of it, it gives you a perspective. It demystifies history, what I do. So
really?
There's a lot of people that approach the past. They'll watch a documentary, they'll read a book, but they don't really know what the things look like, felt like, smelled like, taste like. Those are things that I do have experience with and have informed how I approach what I do. Can I quantify all that? No, it's just, I can tell you for a fact that's the frame of reference for when I write, that all these things are in the back of my mind. If there's a specific lyric, there may actually be a real life component that inspired those two or three lines. that come from my own experience. And then again, there may not be. I don't know. It's a case by case thing.
And what do you mean? Like, what do you mean? Explain, demystify history in that sense, and that you kind of you're not prone to the romantic vision of certain elements of the past because you know the kind of the backstory.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Well, and just when you come to realize that people are people, and human nature hasn't really changed that much.
Yeah.
The clothes have changed. The accoutrements have changed, but when it comes right down to it, not all that much has changed with us. And so when you're reading about something that happened in the past, it's not really possible to explain, say, let's say the 1918 flu pandemic.
Yeah.
Until a year ago, the only people talking about it were historians like me and academics, and maybe the occasional virologist. But now it's everywhere. And it's the kind of thing people that they'll look back on the past and they'll go, well, it had to be a lot different. And in actuality, no, really, it wasn't that much different. I mean, the only things that are different now is that it's more politicized than it was back then, but it was still politicized back then too.
Yeah.
And in terms of demystification, when you look at something from, you know, whether it's 20th century or 19th century or 18th century, when you walk into a museum, you can see that item on a display case, but you'll have a really hard time connecting it with its actual past. And when it comes, like when you think about antiquities, one of the biggest problems and worst crimes about antiquity trafficking is when an artifact is taken from its original context, it's almost impossible to put it back. So if you take a little statuette from an alcove in a Mesoamerican temple and sell it somewhere else, once you remove it from that little place, you've destroyed some aspect of the greater human story. And it is a high crime to me.
Yeah.
But I'm one of those people that is an historian in the things that I've worked with. I'm not watching the History Channel and wondering what does that look like, or not, you're just seeing something on the screen, but not really identifying what it is. I'm one of those people that's been lucky enough to have held it, worn it, you know, tasted it. It's difficult because I've been doing this almost 25 years. And so I've seen a lot of stuff and a wide variety of things. So it's a little tough for me to just kind of encapsulate in a podcast, but
it's
probably clear as mud, right? You know?
An idea that I've often thought about, you know, in as much as that I've always been very interested in history and written about that with primordial or written papers on this, that, and the other thing. But the idea that every generation somehow thinks that it's particularly unusual in its experience of the living through that moment, when in actuality, there are just all these pointers that you can easily explain the human behavior within that moment through our understanding of the past. And we aren't that exceptional, all things considered. But yet at the moment, it just seems like particularly hysterical. Our reaction to the moment. We seem to believe that we're the first people ever to have dealt with any of these things. And, you know, and then you try to say to even just casually say to people like, well, you know, impeachment has happened before. And, you know, whether it was Clinton or Nixon or like, not everything is completely unusual to your moment, if how you interpret it. But I think it speaks to the narcissistic age that we live in, that everybody somehow is playing themselves as the main role in their own movie, so to speak, and that the history bends around them, when in actuality it's completely the opposite. It's kind of
right. We have a similar hubris to the Victorians in the sense that we have this weird belief that we're the pinnacle of evolution.
Yeah.
When there is no pinnacle in evolution, none, you know. But it's like you say, we're a moment in time, we're a snapshot. This is where we are right now. But yeah, there are a lot of people, and there always have been a lot of people that their perspective is entirely a bubble. It's just whatever's around them. And I hear it a lot when I draw an historical parallel to something that's going on. If people don't agree with what I'm saying, because it may seem to undermine their political position, the first thing I hear is, well, that was then, this is now, and it's different. And I'm like, yeah, well, look, history doesn't repeat itself, but it certainly does like certain themes.
Yeah.
And it loves to replay those themes.
Yeah.
And there are certain similarities that an undercurrent in all of those things that you need to pay attention to.
Yeah.
And
I think that entirely speaks to our relationship to, for example, let's say, roughly speaking, in terms of some of the things that are happening in lockdown, i.e. the expedition of some form of, we could observe, technocratic surveillance state. And you say to people, well, this has elements of, the Soviet state, this has elements of Stasi, this and that and the other. And somehow we seem to think especially in Ireland, we go, oh, that can't really happen here. And you go, well, soft authoritarianism, let's put it this way, democracy isn't the default setting of society. And trying to put that across to people now, hey, you need to be aware. But of course, again, everybody has this narcissistic, selfish belief that thinks they're, that kind of thing, they can't learn anything from that. I don't know what I'm trying, what the question is, but you know what I'm trying to get at, maybe, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know lockdown in Europe is a lot more tight than in the U.S. And, you know, in the U.S. we paid a steep price over here. I had COVID last month.
Oh, yeah?
And I had it for 2 weeks. It's not fun.
Yeah.
The U.S. did an absolutely abysmal job addressing it. And a lot of that is the political side of it. I'm not going to get into at this point.
Sure,
but
yeah.
You know what I mean? It was the politics that still informs a lot of people's beliefs about just exactly what the virus is. Mm. People that want to believe it came from somewhere in a lab, I'm like, no. But anyway, reasoning with those people is, it's almost a Clockwork Orange kind of thing where I don't really care to reason with you. It's just got to be a certain way right now so we can get through this.
Yeah.
This is, like you said, democracy is not a default setting. And what we're going through right now is in a default setting. It's not going to become a default setting. At least, in this country. I can't speak to over there. You guys have to sort that out yourselves.
Yeah.
The U.S., I think the U.S. is probably done trying to export democracy. I think we've finally learned that if you want it, you got to get it yourself, kid. Mm. At least I hope we've learned that. I don't know where I was going with all that.
No. I find it interesting. And just the idea that what I've been trying to sort of, I suppose, pivot between is the belief, the sort of narcissistic belief that modern society has to not learn from the past, but yet also try and believe that it's still this, acting the centerpiece in the movie of its own life, so to speak. And also the kind of lack of, maybe let's call it emotional understanding or political or historical understanding, to at least when I, trying to move into saying to people like, hey, you should recognize the signposts on the way to the soft trajectory of authoritarianism, because they're everywhere. And then the idea that we have nothing to learn from the signposts of history that lead people into the same penury state is, it's so, to me, so naive and so such a misreading of history that I sometimes can't quite fathom our inability to learn from that. I don't know if that's a question or a statement or whatever.
Well, and I know what you're saying, and it's a difficult thing indeed, because we can point to certain periods in history or specific events, and they may or may not apply to what's going on right now. Mm-hmm. And again, that's where I get a lot of pushback. If I'll point to something, the big thing right now is, oh, we're in a new Weimar period. And I'm like, really?
Yeah. Okay.
And have this conversation again,
Yeah.
As an historian, it's something that you attempt to deconstruct for people, and maybe not, if you're not trying to deconstruct it, you're trying to put it in perspective. And again, it's the perspective that you're talking about, where your belief that it's going in this one direction may not be true. It may be true. I don't know. But is that going to be the end? There's no end to all this. This is the other thing that I think is underpins a lot of the fear in our societies and cultures, is that if it goes this way, it's going to be that way forever. History shows the one overarching theme is that it doesn't stay the same, and that there are massive changes. And I'm one of those guys that, you know, I look back on the past, and the guys in the band will tell you this. For the last 5, 7, 8 years, I've been asking, is there going to be some world convulsion similar to what happened in the early 19th century, within the first 20 years of the 19th century being Napoleon, and in the 20th century being the First World War? Is there going to be something that sets the tone for the entire century? Or is society going to gently evolve, be allowed to gently evolve without some big cataclysmic event?
Yeah.
And now I have my answer.
Yeah.
You know, but I've been asking, is there going to be something? Now, is that a hard and fast rule? Is the 22nd century going to have something like that? Not necessarily.
Yeah.
But, you know, my opposite number in 2115 is going to be asking the same question. Is there going to be something that happens here in the next 5 or 10 years that's going to set the tone for the century?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, maybe I should know better, but somehow it feels like this is a part of it. Or, you know, when they talk about the fourth industrial revolution or all that kind of thing, you do feel that, as boring as it is to be this last year is, somehow there is a recalibration of certain elements that I feel may be happening, and that this may be one of those pivotal moments in history. But again, maybe that's my own algorithm feeding me my own, you know, crazy outrage, because I'm in essentially isolation for the last year. So I've been trying to hold the line between what is my own perception, which is just, on a screen, which is inspired by my own, I suppose, sense of outrage or many other things, and what is actually happening. So the idea of what's malign, what's benign, what's malice, what's incompetence, what's this, that, or it's very hard to judge, because at the end of the day, it can still just be a botched response by a broken system run by cowards. And that can explain a lot of it, or it can explain very little of it.
It's probably going to explain a lot of it, man. Come on.
Yeah. But that's what I hope. I hope it does. And that the malign Machiavellian, let's say, you know, authoritarian surveillance state section of it has been pushed to the periphery by, as I said, the botched system, blah, 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 blah. But again, it's very hard to know, because at the end of the day, we all, especially here, you sit at the end of the screen and you take in your information and you try and judge that based on your own previous life experience, because you were able to assess more of the world than you are now, because you can't really do anything. So it's brain break.
Yeah, it really is. And yeah, it's kind of funny, when I had COVID and I was down for 2 weeks, I mean, one of the worst things you can do to me is give me a lot of time to think. I can go down some really dark rabbit holes. And I did. I really went down some dark rabbit holes.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I was able to come out of that fog and separate that wheat from the chaff and go, okay, was I thinking clearly? Most of the time, no.
Yeah.
Was my own sickness informing a lot of my trepidations? Yeah. But, you know, for a while there, sometimes it can seem very real. And maybe there are people that cannot separate those things over time. Maybe their greatest fears become their ultimate motivation.
Yeah, I think you could probably say that within the polarization that's happening, people flock to the polarization of the other side, just because those people have the bullhorn and everybody else in the middle is, if you're trying to toe the line or hold the line for reason and rationality or empiricism or whatever else, you get shouted down, because you aren't on the periphery with the bullhorn screaming at all the people in the middle going, come over here, you know. So it is very hard to hold the line, so to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It can be. It's just it's up to your individual constitution.
This is it, and
your own integrity.
This is it. But so that's the brain breaking part of the podcast. That could be my middle section, this sort of, you know, where people message me, go, what the fuck, you know. But it's interesting. I know. I just find it fascinating, because it's I'm trying to sort of throw the net here and there with different people that I feel are going to have interesting responses to this strange position where we find ourselves now, you know. But it is at the end of the day, trying to sense make is very difficult right now in a world that seems to be at the end of a 10-year derangement cycle prompted by the social media, you know, which we never quite had that constantly poking our lizard brain in the same way before. I think that's a new phenomenon or a new stimulus.
And then, and using the term lizard brain is appropriate because that's really what it's appealing to.
Yeah.
It's appealing to that very base of the brain that is programmed for jealousy, hatred, territoriality. That's exactly what it's speaking to. And now it's up to the rest of the gray matter that's evolved to have that honest conversation with itself and go, all right, look, you're probably imagining a lot of this. Be on guard, always be on guard, but don't get too worked up.
That's exactly what I've been trying to do, to try and hold the line between that side of my personality that sees those dark things and the other side of my personality that's just like, look, just this is also, as I said, a botched response by a broken system. So you need to fucking hold your tongue and bide your time a little bit. But yet at the same time, you know, the truth can lie somewhere in the middle. And that even if it lies in the middle or even 20% in, it still can have great repercussions for civil liberty or freedom or that kind of thing.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, and a critical appraisal of where we are culturally, politically, is very difficult to do as individuals, and more especially collectively. And information literacy is another area where the pandemic has really exposed how they're not cracks, they're absolute gorges between peoples. There are so many people that will hear one thing, and if it's packaged just right, they'll go, that's got to be it. I mean, it makes sense to me. But that's the thing about misinformation, is it comes into the world fully formed as this neat little package that's easy to swallow and move on with your life.
Yeah.
Whereas objective truth or empiricism, as you said earlier, that comes a lot slower, and it can be a lot more difficult to connect those dots. And so it requires patience and circumspection.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's not something that most people excel in.
It's not just that they don't excel in it. It's just that they're not given the time to. Because if let's say I send you a particular a message filled with misinformation, and you read it and go, oh, that seems to agree with my worldview, you just forward that on to 50 other people straight away. Like these things have legs faster than the sense-making abilities of our structures or institutions are able to cope with, or even our own brain is able to cope with. That's why I picked the lizard brain.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
It just keeps.
Yeah. That's exactly what I'm talking about. It comes into the world fully formed. It's easier to disperse and it appeals to a wide public. And that's the great tragedy. And that's why objective truth has a much harder time hammering itself into the skulls of people and going, look, you need to take a step back and look at the whole picture of whatever this little thing is we're talking about.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things. Yeah. It astounds me as an astronomer for 46 years, that astrology still exists, that this belief in pseudosciences still exists.
Sure.
And I'm just thinking, it's 2021. If astrology worked, we fucking know it by now.
Sure.
Whether you want to look at Ptolemy's astrology that comes out of the Tetrabiblos, or you want to go back to the great ancient mystical texts, it's never proven itself. Why are we still talking about this? yet it's still a wide open field, and a lot of major media outlets still have they still have articles about astrology. And I'm like,
it just appeals to our sense of romance, maybe, you know, the idea
the heart of thinking, because ultimately it doesn't take a lot of time to look at astrology columns between two different media for a given day and see they don't agree at all, and they're not even predictions. They're just random abstract advice about how you should live.
Yeah,
there's no connection between them, and yet those dots are never connected by the vast majority of people. Why? Well, I think it's because, there's that great series on Netflix that I can't wait to binge tonight, you know, or the sports ball is on. Shut up. I'm going to watch that now. And there's just too many distractions.
Yeah, no, there is. There's too many distractions. If people just want a simple bite-sized take on their own, where their own morality should be pointing to, or their own emotional state should be pointed to. I can understand it in for some people sometimes, i.e. the fact that there's the romance of the journey doesn't mean there's a destination intellectually or something like this. I'm not sure how to describe it, but maybe something like mm-hmm. that those kind of things, they also give people comfort in a way that maybe those of us who try and cut straight to the bone of the matter don't feel we need, which maybe leaves other people unmoored and heading out into very deep waters that they don't really want to go to. So I find that repeatedly in the last year, hypothesizing about some of the things that may or may not happen, but I find it interesting to think about. But I find them with many people, they push back against it because they will go, these things are just too dark for me. Like, the waters are too deep, so to speak, not to sound patronizing, but I can't live my life if I feel that those things may come true. So that speak, I think that says a lot in relation to what you just said. Maybe, you know, maybe.
Yeah, I always think about it. Well, I get what you're saying. It brings to mind that the last scene in Life of Brian.
Oh, yeah.
Where Eric Idle's on the crucifix and he goes, "Cheer up, Brian, it may never happen." I think it was in that. Anyway, it said, "Cheer up, it may never happen." I think that's damn good advice. You know?
It is. I'm going to, my brain is going off into a dozen different tangents, but I know that people want me to ask you about all this kind of stuff, which is the Bathory stuff, right? You were a close friend of Cawthon, right?
Yes.
And so,
yes,
obviously, such an enigma that he was. Everybody who knew I was, you know, people knew who knew you a bit, who knew I was going to speak to, were like, "Oh, you need to ask him about the Bathory stuff." But how did you get to know him? Or was it just from writing letters originally, or what? How did it work?
Yeah. I wrote him a letter in 1987. The first time I heard Bathory is 86. Mm. And it was on the Speed Kills 2 compilation, which is like my favorite compilation of all time. Under the Sign came out and it just blew my mind. You know, I love the first two, but Under the Sign came out and blew my mind. And I'm like, I got to write this. I got to get to the bottom of this. I was curious, right?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
And I don't know what it was about my letters, but it pushed all the right buttons. And we just kept this correspondence all the way through his life. Mm. And, you know, kind of, I had the opportunity to look behind the curtain. And, you know, I went to Echo and stayed with Boss.
Yeah.
And Claudia in 2006, and my family and I went back in 2008. So I've gotten to look behind the curtain. Now, there are people, obviously, that were closer to him in proximity, like Rex, that worked with him from, I think it was Twilight of the Gods on, that, you know, bar buddies, guys. I mean, guys that you could say were actually really close, true friends that went out and hung out whenever he felt like it anyway. But in terms of knowing him personally, I don't know how well they might have known him. And I ask his dad, I'm like, you know, look, this is Ace and I's history. It's kind of weird to me. He goes, "Well, you knew him better than basically everybody else."
Mm.
And my mind just went poof, at that point. I'm like, me? Why me?
Yeah.
I don't know. And I've been working with Chris Maycock on the upcoming Bathory book. Helping him connect dots and check the timeline on things. And it's astonishing. It's going to be a hell of a book. I'm learning things, you know, and I remember there were things I would ask Ace about. I'm like, "Remember when you said this?" I don't remember that at all. What? So, you know, he forgot things about his life, just like we always forget things about our own lives. Somebody can come up to you and go, "Hey, remember that time you wore those khaki trousers on whatever?" You know, I don't remember that.
Yeah.
But it sticks in someone's mind for whatever reason.
Yeah.
The short answer is, you could say I knew him.
And did this develop from like a letter writing sort of 80s thing into, I suppose, a personal relationship where you met him a few times and all that kind of thing?
No, we never actually met.
Really?
We never got to meet.
Oh, right. Because it's a really strange...
Yeah, he would go out on those little tours.
Yeah.
He would go out on those promo tours, but I mean, when he came to America, it was New York and LA.
Yeah.
You know, that's basically it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm stuck in the middle of the country. I'm 2 days away from New York, 2 days away from LA. So,
yeah. But I suppose that it's interesting to me because it's sort of, it's a very underground metal letter writing story, but yet it betrays a, and I mean that in a positive way that people say that, it betrays a quite old fashioned sense of knowing someone. Is it through their letters can sometimes give you a very great insight into mm-hmm. where they are as a person. You know, we all know mm-hmm. famous letter writing compendiums between poets who never met. I think it can be give you a very good insight into somebody, though.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the people that I have a lot of my life has revolved around is H.G. Wells, and his correspondence volumes are just massive. The volumes are so big and so expensive, I don't even have them. Most of his papers are one state away over in Illinois, at the University of Illinois. But I mean, it's absolutely true. And it's one of those things, because I ask his dad, I'm like, you know, it's just really weird to me that you came to me to help, and you came to me to help you with the box set, which that's its own little story. But why me? He's like, because he talked about you. And he talked about your family often. He goes, I know who you are. I knew who you were years ago.
Yeah.
And he valued you above pretty much everybody else. And I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah.
A little old me. But then I go back and I was talking about the book earlier with that Chris is writing. It sent me back to those old letters that I kept.
Yeah.
And when I reread those old letters, I'm like, yeah, I know what his dad meant. I get it now. We really did know each other.
Yeah, it's bizarre because in the last few weeks, I've been talking to Chris as well. And I lost most of my old cassettes through moving through Dublin's different, houses and stuff. But there is about 100 or 200 that are left from the 80s. One of them I found has Corthon radio interview, Portuguese radio 1990, and then one with fans mm-hmm. in the street, which I think is with Fernando from Moonspell. It's sitting in a tape behind me, and I'm just waiting to digitize it and then throw it to Chris and kind of go, here, got something you need to take from this. But even for all my friends in the Swedish scene, whether they're, Niflheim, Marduk, Unleash, Dismember, all of those people, when you say to them, do any of you know him? They're all like, no, no one knew him. The only person I ever met who really sort of knew a bit was Leif Edling from Candlemas. And Leif told me a couple of really, really great, mm-hmm. great stories about him from 82, 83, 84, about going out, like boating out to the mm-hmm. island to watch them rehearse and all that kind of stuff. I guess I've been trying to put Chris onto Leif. I don't know where Leif is right now when it comes to correspondence. That was never, I think, his main thing. But no one.
Right. He wouldn't have had to, but yeah.
Yeah. But very few people seem to really know him.
Right. And that was the thing when we talk on the phone, it was, you know, long distance is expensive. So it's not like
we
talked very often. Yeah, yeah. And what we talked about was really basic. It was the letters that we would really dig in and talk about personality things, that we were doing, aspirations, girlfriends, you know, all the personal stuff. That's where all of that really happened. Mm. I asked his dad, you know, why, when I was asking him why me, and he's like, well, I think you were the one guy that kept a correspondence with him the longest, because everybody else has this episodic approach to him. You know, the guys that were in the band from March of 83, they were out by like the end of 83, basically. Mm. You know, that tumultuous lineup, the infamous story of the tumultuous lineups. I guess I was the one guy that just kept up with him, and he kept up with me, and here we are.
I mean, there's so many enigmas to even try and dig down into, but like, even just, there's a few from my own experience that I thought were a little bit curious. I remember, because I did this Twilight of the Gods band with Runa, from who was in Mayhem, Nick Barker played the drums, Patrick from Tearfing played the guitar, and Froda from Einherjar played the bass. And the idea was that in a bar bet, someone bet me, this is about 12 or 14 years ago, hey, it's almost 20 years up to Hammerheart, why doesn't Primordial do you know, because without Hammerheart and Blood for Death, there isn't really any Primordial or probably many other, you know, sort of second generation black epic bands. So, we kind of took that template. But my mate bet me, why don't you do a Primordial? And I said, I'll tell you what, we'll do a bet. I'll put together a band to play like Under the Ruins and Shores in Flames and all this kind of stuff. And he went, yeah, right, okay. And so literally next day I started texting the people. And we did it, you know, we did like maybe 20, 25 gigs maybe or something like this. But we did the stuff from Twilight of the Gods as well. And I never forget Runa from Mayhem and all this stuff. He's like an amazing guitar player. And we were doing, I think, Through Blood by Thunder. And he was just, you know, and we finished rehearsing a song. And he just looked at me and he goes, that's not Quorthon playing that guitar on that record. He's just like, how did he go from that to Requiem to Octagon to whatever? And it always stuck in my mind. Runa, who was just like, fuck, you know, doing this, some of the stuff. And always, you know, maybe you as a guitar player, I don't know, it sounds like sacrilege, like because it's when I say it, it doesn't sound right to say, but how, you know, seeing as we're just being nerdy about it, but how to go from such a pinnacle of guitar playing at Twilight Gods, it seemed like he just kind of went, a bit after that with Octagon and all those records. It's just like he didn't give a shit.
He did. I mean, and Requiem, he used to tell me, he and I agreed, Requiem is a fantastic album, and it was one of his favorite Bathory albums. And it's because a lot of things came together for that one. It was, you know, he was really sensitive to what his fan base wanted. He wanted to make them happy above everything else. So whatever communications he was hearing from people, what they liked, what they didn't like, he would take that on board and try to give the fans what they wanted within his own particular style and you know, what he felt like. I remember I asked him about Twilight of the Gods at one point, and he's like, you know, by the end of that, I was so fucking fed up with it all. He goes, I just pushed the levels up and said, forget it. I can't do this anymore. He was exhausted by that album. You know, and of course, then there's other things going on in life that all of us face that he's dealing with too. And so I could see him just going, whatever. I'm glad you like it, Chuck, but you know, that was a really rough time in life. And I was really tired of a lot of things.
Well, I mean, it sounds like an exhausting record to make, but the fact that it just felt like that to me as somebody who loved Bathory, that, and then when we went to rehearse those songs, just that the other guys were like, what's going on here? How did his playing level just seem to dip so dramatically when you come to some of those mid to late 90s records and the Nordland stuff. I don't know. It was just a nerdy guitar question.
Nordland was, the Nordland albums were basically the mixing of those styles.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
You know, because there's a lot of epic stuff on there. And then he returned to some speedy stuff on, like, I think, Sign of the Silver Hammer or whatever. You know, there's some stuff that just, you know, bangs out really hard. I don't think that he stepped back from his playing. I think he was just like, why am I trying so hard? Mm. You know, it's like, what am I going to do that's bigger and better than Twilight of the Gods? It's like Slayer after Rain and Blood. They're like, they look around like, we can't, this is the pinnacle for us. We're just going to go do something else.
Yeah.
You know, you could have the same conversation about Slayer. Like, well, why is South of Heaven so weak? You know, why Seasons in the Abyss even weaker? Well, yeah, they've already done everything they can do.
I would have the I would have the Seasons in the Abyss comment, but I really do love, I love South Heaven. It's a dark, brooding sort of record that went off in an angle off Rain of Blood. But I do take the point. But it just seemed strange to me that Twilight of the Gods has this massive production values, and then it just kind of, you went, all right, we're going to go back to, well, not, but not 1983, to some other place. But did you get the impression? This is one of the things I got when I sat down with Leif from Candlemass. We sat at Roadburn for a long, long time and talked about all these old stories. And Leif kind of gave me the impression that for the last 10 or 15 years of his life, in that he'd been the rock star in the 80s and the early 90s, but that because he never stepped out onto the stage to play live, the mechanism that would have kept him going, so to speak, on those terms, had ceased to be, because scenes had moved on and people had moved on. And Leif kind of started, intimated to me that he got the impression he was a bit of a sort of lonely dude at the end, the last few years. Maybe that's a sort of personal question. I don't know. But I suppose when you relate...
It's pretty personal, but I don't think it's too far, too wide of the mark. I think he liked his privacy. You know, the whole family is very private. It's a private family. And... Mm-hmm. He's just one of those guys. He didn't mind being on his own. home and, you know, together about that. But yeah, I think it's a pretty astute observation, frankly.
Well, I have a very good, I haven't seen her in a few years, but a good friend of mine, Jeanette, German girl, she used to do this band called Bather Lord and a whole bunch of other stuff. I haven't seen her for a few years. He had like 120 Bathory shirts, and she met him two or three times actually in Sweden in the 2000s. And she sort of said to me at the same time, he struck her, if I'm sorry, Jeanette, if you're watching and I'm wrongly paraphrasing you, but it seemed like the moment had passed to step out onto the stage to finally do it, even though I heard there was money offered by Wacken and all this kind of stuff. And then we heard the crazy story, oh, Edge of Sanity are going to be his backing band. And it just seemed to me that somehow taking that leap of faith might have given the last couple of years of being in the band a sort of new sense of purpose or meaning, that which I don't understand why he didn't take that jump. Was it the guitar playing, the voice? Do you have an intimation as to why?
I think he was so just demoralized by the inability to hold the lineup together that it just didn't seem worth it. He could still do his studio projects and just live his life without having to get involved in all the band bullshit.
I also had the
same dream that you did about, you know, is Kurt going to ask you to sing? I was always like, is Ace ever going to call me to be his rhythm guitarist? Because I'll do that in a second, man. Yeah. Just sign me up.
Yeah, yeah. But it's because it kind of struck me that, well, what we heard was like, because when Primordial started to play a couple of the bigger festivals here and there in 2008, 2001, 2002, but we took little steps up, incremental steps up, but you began to hear gossip when you would poke, you know, drunk booking agents at Wacken or whatever. They were sitting around there going, oh yes, we offered Bathory X amount of money to play, but in the end we got Nocturno Culto with Satyricon singing Dark Throne instead. And you're like, all right, okay, 2004, whatever it was. And then somebody else tells you, yeah, they wanted Edge of Sanity, or like I said, Edge of Sanity, or whoever it was, to be the backing band. But yet at the 11th hour, he kind of went, no, I don't want to do it. Or like, did you have a sense of why? I mean, I don't know. I make up the answers in my head. They've been going around in my head for years. Do you think there was an element of like maybe fear at getting it wrong for all the people who love the band so many years to stand up on the stage?
No, I don't think that was it at all. I don't think that it was the right time. I don't think his heart was into it at that point, because if he wanted it to happen, he could have made it happen.
Yeah. That's what I think.
I think the pretense would have been, well, we can't have the big Manowar Kiss kind of production with the bombs and all that. But I honestly think a lot of that was pretense.
Yeah, because that's what I heard. The story I heard was that Wacken had offered that slot, like the huge stage, and we'll put the stuff up, we'll put the huge thing, we'll do. That will be part of the thing. That now, of course, you know, Holger from Wacken probably has he knows, of course, more than me. I'm just some fucking peripheral, you know, lad trying to listen to some gossip of my childhood hero that maybe would step out on the stage. But it just seemed like maybe the moment had passed. I find it hard to deal with the fact that it could just be logistics, because that would, you know what I mean?
Well, because you and I are fans and we really wanted it to happen. You know, we really wanted to see that happen.
I wanted it to happen like amazingly well. It would break my heart if it was bad. So I was kind of on a knife edge about it. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry to interrupt you, but you know.
Yeah. And I mean, I wanted it to happen too, but I only wanted it to happen if he wanted it to happen.
Yeah.
And I just, those last years, I mean, I don't know how to pull all this together succinctly, but there was a lot going on in his life that I think that might have just been too distracting. And ultimately if he was thinking about the band at all,
Yeah, yeah.
He was thinking about what he was going to do on the next record.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, the idea of suddenly having to face everything that we in active bands do, we in bands that go out and play, that was just like, oh God, you know. And the weird thing is his dad, that's what he did since the 60s, you know.
Yeah.
Beria knew, I mean, he was involved, deeply involved in the music business. So dad could have pulled all this together.
Yeah.
But I just, it could have been just, it such a hassle, a hassle. And even though you've got all these people offering to do all this for you, how do you know they're going to do it the way you want it done? And I just, I don't know. I think if it were, and I'm looking at it through my lens, I could see him just going, you know what? Nah, forget it.
Especially maybe.
You know, but there may be more to the story than that too. I don't know.
Yeah. Especially if you haven't taken the early baby steps. Like as in you hadn't played a couple of club gigs and you hadn't played a couple of gigs where you'd had to cope with, oh, the fucking amp head doesn't work and the pedal, you know, like the things we all do as teenagers.
Right.
Like, because Leaf told me a story about them rowing out to the island, you know, where they rehearse, or going to watch them, to watch Battery rehearse with all the gear and all the backdrops and all that kind of stuff in 82 or 83, but I guess 83. And that they would bring a few beers and sit. And it was as near to a gig as it ever got. But at the same time, it wasn't a gig.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, that was, I guess, Nemesis, the pre-Candlemas thing. So they were trying to play in Youth Halls. Leaf was up there trying to sing by his own admission. He was like, oh, I'm not really into this. But making mistakes to learn from. Whereas when you think about Bathory, you think he never learned those stage mistakes to learn from. So imagine they happen in front of 40,000 people at Wacken. Maybe that pressure is great. You know what I mean?
That could have been. It very well could have been. That's as good an explanation as any, frankly.
Yeah, it's been going around in my head for decades and decades, you know.
You know, because you would hear stories from, you know, people like me, and you know, he had to have written to some other guys in bands that were telling him stories too. Yeah. He had to hear these stories.
Yeah.
Stories like, oh my God, you know, OFC, there's a, in my, I had a Marshall MOSFET, one of those field effect transformers. It starts playing a baseball game. And so in between OFC songs, it's the Kansas City Royals versus the St. Louis Cardinals. And you're like, I mean, it was a total Spinal Tap moment.
Yeah.
You know, and for me, you know, for OFC, you're like, oh, this is great. This is funny. This is funny as hell. This is what a great story, you know. I could see it be daunting.
But when you think about it, let's say mid-2000s, I'm sure somebody could have quite easily said to all of Emperor, by the way, can you learn all of these songs and perfectly execute them and stand at the back? It's Emperor. Of course, it's probably going to be flawless execution if it's Ishan and stuff. And they probably could have gone, learn all of it. You know, Corthon, you just step in, play, rehearse once or twice. You don't need to know these guys, play. I mean, for sure, by the time the 2000s, you know, late 2000s came along, there were so many great musicians that, you know, when you talk about the people you rehearsed with in the 80s, and then you compare them to some of the people he could have potentially had, like, step up and play with him. You know, you could just have stepped on stage with a Satyricon or an Emperor. But maybe, in my head, he's so far removed from that scene and those people to not know.
Absolutely.
That was maybe.
Absolutely. I mean, he never impressed me as being all that comfortable with what the Norwegians did to his legacy. They took one album and they drove it into the fucking ground. Mm. And that was an album that his feelings on Under the Sign are like my feelings on Stillbirth Machine. It's like, why do you like that album so much? Listen to it. It sounds awful. You know, and I made similar mistakes on Stillbirth Machine that he made on Under One Sign. Maybe that's one of the things that united us in the very beginning. I don't know.
Yeah.
So, you know, he experimented with the Rockman guitar box and I did too.
Sure.
You know, it's like they took that one aspect of the Bathory sound and like, that's Bathory. And he's like, no, it's not. You know, and so there was a lot of that. And then there was all the, you know, the political controversy and the church burnings and the murders and all that. And he's just like, that's not me.
Yeah.
Come on.
I mean,
why do I get tagged with this?
Yeah, I mean, I just picked their name kind of out of the hat. It could have been, I mean, look, he could have used any band in the world probably to be his backing.
Well, but I mean, ultimately, we're talking about, you know, Bathory, everybody thinks, you say Bathory, most people think black metal. And so what has black metal become since 1991? This Norwegian thing.
Sure.
So, you know, from his perspective, I remember one time he sent me, it had to be 92, one of the very first covers albums that somebody did, and they sent it to him, and it was a bunch of Greek bands that had covered Bathory. And he sends me this tape. He goes, listen to this and tell me honestly, was Bathory really this bad? No, you weren't that bad. Yeah. So his the feedback, I guess what I'm trying to say is the feedback that he was getting from fans, I can see him kind of going, I've been completely misinterpreted here. Mm. And
but in a way, maybe, I mean, there were so many bands who came after, you know, influenced by Hammer and Twilight of the Gods that were maybe bubbling under the surface. And I would count Primordial amongst those bands who took the epic template and sort of, and the whole early pagan metal scene that maybe he might have maybe been more comfortable with, the Enslaves or the, I don't know, Gunagora Bunjits or many, many bands of that ilk who were not the church burning, you know. Mm-hmm. It was far less controversial, maybe. But in my head, head, I'm thinking to myself, he's just listening to Kiss. He's not paying any attention to any of this stuff, you know.
He's listening to Kiss. He's listening to Motorhead. He's listening to the Sex Pistols. He's listening to Toya Wilcox and Kate Bush, and a lot of classical music.
Yeah, yeah.
He and I were exactly alike like that. Yeah. Well, except I never liked Kiss. I can't say I like Kiss. I never liked Kiss.
Yeah, the Irish people are just a bit. You know, Kiss reformed for their Psycho Circus tour. And in Dublin, they were in this, like, I guess, booked into this 12,000 seat arena and sold less than 1,000 tickets in 1993 or four. Irish people just went, ugh, look, we like AC/DC. We don't like this. Of course, it changed a little bit when Kiss came around 30 years later for their farewell, 25 years later. But the Kiss thing, I get it, but I also don't get it. I prefer AC/DC.
Well, he was super excited. We were talking on the phone back in 96, and it was when Kiss had just pulled Ace Frehley back in the band. They put on the makeup again, did that big world tour as the original Kiss. He was kind of excited. Oh, was that what it was? He was kind of excited about that. You know, he's like, I'm going to go see that. It's going to be cool. You know, but he goes, I'm not expecting a return to 1977.
No.
He goes, but it's going to be cool.
Yeah. You know. But when you think about it, 1996 is not that far from 1977. But we were just talking about the beginning. We're further. We're a decade and more away from Stillbirth Machine. Sitting here talking now.
We started recording Stillbirth Machine 30 years ago this summer. We're 30 years on. That material is basically written by now.
Yeah, that fucks with my head because, you know, that thing when somebody says, "Oh, like you remember when you bought into the Pandemonium." It was 4 years past Kill 'Em All, but Kill 'Em All felt ancient in a way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now
look where we are.
We're 30 years on from Stillbirth Machine having this conversation about, for whatever reason, this the first time we've had this conversation. That sort of, it doesn't impact me. It impacts me very strangely because it doesn't feel like that long ago. But yet 83 to 87, I guess, feels like a long time when you're an adolescent,
teenager,
or something like that.
Because you don't have a frame of reference yet. You're still a kid. You haven't lived all that long. But, you know, you can play that numbers game. 30 years on from 1991, 30 years before that, there's no Beatles. It's still Chuck Berry, you know, duck walking across the stage, you know, 1961. Yeah. So, yeah, these are the spans of time we're talking about. What's amazing to me is the fact that metal is still basically identifiable. You look at the difference between rock and roll in 1961 and 1991. We have a lot more in common today with 1991 than 1991 did with 1961, in my view anyway. But I'm a metal guy, so that's my frame of reference for it.
I need to think about that. But I know I understand what you mean, because it's just the longevity thing is that Kill 'Em All is only 14 years after the first Black Sabbath album. But here we are talking about something that's 30 years ago.
Yeah.
It's a strange thing. I had this conversation. I was talking to Jason from Misery Index just about that death metal purple patch in 1991 or so. And yeah, again, it's also 30 years ago. But yet, 2005 feels like about 6 months ago to me. But I suppose that's... that's
1986 feels 6 months ago to me.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I suppose that's the damned privilege of, you know, getting older, I suppose, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a privilege denied to some.
Exactly. I think on that moment, this will be a good moment to press stop. And so.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.